Since we have seen so many things, I just find useful to go through them quickly to set the stage. And now that you tried in tutorial to do these computations by yourself, you might see that there are some things that you don't remember fully or you're a bit confused about. So I hope this helps putting things to memory a little bit. So we call this a Lagrangian symmetry or a Noetherian symmetry a transformation of field space such that the variation of the Lagrangian is a boundary term. From this, we could deduce Noether's theorem. In particular, Noether 1 says that one can define a current dj as the valuation of the presymplectic potential current on a symmetry transformation, corrected by this lack of invariance of the Lagrangian, this boundary term. So this object, the theorem says, is the variation of this object is nothing else than the equation of motion contracted with a symmetry transformation of the field, which therefore vanishes on shell, and this makes our current conserved. Now, one can push the construction a little bit farther to compute what the what does the Hamiltonian flow equation looks like for such a symmetry, for such a Lagrangian symmetry, and one finds that indeed, a priori, one expects that the Noether current is generating the transformation, but in fact, there can be obstructions, and these obstructions are such that on shell, they are corner terms, because here this is already at top minus one. These are already top minus one forms, and so R itself must be a top minus two. So it's a corner contribution. In Young-Mills theory, one is what I call the best case scenario, where things are particularly simple because the Lagrangian is invariant on the nose, which means that R xi can be set to zero. And on top, one can check that the symplectic potential is invariant under the gauge transformation. And if you do this, you realize that this equation written in using Cartan's formulas, instead of doing a direct computation of how all the pieces transform, you write it as the contraction of the variation plus the variation of the contraction. You find directly this flow equation, which says that rho xi omega is equal minus dj for j, which is simply, well, there's no R term. And in this case, you can see there is no obstruction at all. Next, we specialize to local symmetries. Which are, if you want, symmetries in which the parameter can be chosen pointwise. So what one has in mind here is either vector fields over your manifold, this is GR, or maybe something like in Mills, where these are functions valued in a finite dimensional Lie algebra. So in both cases, these are sections of some bundle over the manifold itself. And from using neuter 1 and pushing it a bit farther, one can prove neuter 2. Neuter 2 tells us that if we write delta xi phi I as some differential operator acting on xi, then the formal adjoint of this operator acting on the equations of motion must give zero. So this is the definition of this symbol. This is the result. So this tells us that not all equations of motion are independent, and the consequence, and how many are dependent on each other, where there are number alpha relations among number I equation of motion. So we have number of indices I minus number of indices alpha equations of motion. So this is, it tells us that the evolution is underdetermined, and therefore, for determinism to be saved, we will have to identify certain solutions with each other. Underdetermined dynamics to save determinism need to identify solutions. Okay, so I haven't given examples of these relationships here, so let me do it now. So we have Yang-Mills. In Yang-Mills, phi I is A alpha A. So the index I is a collective index alpha A. Alpha is Lie algebra valued and A is spacetime valued. Now, the equations of motion are D B alpha B A. It's a bit ugly, but okay. Let me put it here. So F is the curvature of A. The equations of, or maybe a bit nicer. Let me do it like this. It reads a bit more clearly, even though I erased and lowered some stuff, but doesn't matter. So these are my equations of motion. You recognize it for Maxwell theory, it's just a divergence of F mu nu, F A B. And then I need to say what is this one to conclude. This is dA of xi. Right? So this is what, and this has two indices. This is the covariant derivative of xi along A. And it has indices A and alpha, as expected, because this is just I. And therefore, this operator over here, d alpha I, in this case, is delta alpha beta d beta minus f alpha, I'm making a disaster, what am I doing? Let me write this one, it's a bit easier. Gamma, A gamma, Ah, I see. Because I is already, S2 is, I is both an A and an alpha. So this will be I A alpha beta. Okay, that's my confusion. So this will be D of alpha beta A. In fact, the A should be downstairs, and this one should be upstairs. A alpha beta. So this becomes delta alpha beta dA, which is the case of, if it is abelian over there. And then there is the commutation relations with this, which gives me beta alpha gamma AA gamma. And that's it. Does that make sense? So if I contract with Xi, I get the derivative of Xi plus the commutation between A and Xi in the Lie algebra, because these are the structure constants. So the adjoint of this operator is nothing else than, if this is, I'm running a bit out of symbol, that's why I'm hesitating, because I have too many D's, and they look all the same on the blackboard. So this is a covariant divergence. This is a gradient. If you integrate by parts the gradient, you get the divergence. So let me call it divergence A, if that makes sense. This equation over here, di alpha ei, is D. So this D is not that D. This D is what I'm calling, this is where I'm running into troubles with my notation. This is dA, is the covariant derivative along. So maybe I call this double D, double D. Just to distinguish it. So this is the same D as here. This D is D plus A. So this is basically D. This is basically the covariant derivative D with an index down, and this is the covariant derivative with the index up. So this is D B D A D B F A B. All of this to say. And this is indeed identically zero. It's very easy to see in Maxwell because you have something antisymmetric that you contract with two derivatives which are symmetric in these indices A and B, so it must give zero. In Young-Mills, you get the doubt that this can be true because there are all these extra things, but indeed, this identity holds also in the non-abelian case. So we see that since here there is a free index alpha, there are alpha number of these equations, one per each element in the basis of the Lie algebra. Okay, so this is Young-Mills. Let's do GR. I should have done Maxwell and then say that Young-Mills works the same. It would have been maybe a bit clearer. In GR, we have that phi I is GAB. So I is a double index, spacetime index this time, instead of one space and one internal. So the equations of motion are given by the Einstein tensor GAB, which is RAB minus 1/2 RGAB. What is delta xi of GAB? Well, this is the Lie derivative of G along psi, which is also dA psi B plus dB psi A. So it has a structure which is formally similar, is the derivative, a covariant derivative of psi. Of course, the details change, but structurally they're similar. So this D becomes a covariant derivative itself, essentially, with some symmetrization thing going on, but is a is a covariant derivative. So we expect, in fact, the same type of result. The difference is that here the equations of motion are the derivative of f. There is just g. So if I work, I find that notor 2 tells me that this is dA gAB, which is sometimes called Bianchi. Is not quite Bianchi, but okay. So this is what gives you the and you, one thing I didn't mention is that if I add current, like electric current here, or stress energy in there, these identities give me the conservation, the on-shell conservation of the electric current and of the stress energy, right? Because this is sourced by J, the electric current. So this becomes the divergence of the electric current equals zero. And this becomes the divergence of T mu nu equals zero. So these play a very crucial role in the dynamics, of course. It's not just a curiosity. Good. Now, just to get us where I was last time, we see that there is one last consequence. I can still push my Noether theorem a bit farther and say, okay, here I found some consequences for the equations of motion, which I found by looking at this side of this equality, basically. If I go back and look at the left-hand side, I can find a consequence for J now. And part two of the theorem is that I said that the charges for one of these local symmetries, which are integral over sigma of J, these vanish on shell, provided that there is no boundary, because there was this argument where we took two slices and say that, oh, what if we Q must be conserved by that theorem? But if we choose Xi to vanish on one slice, then the other one must be equal. So this must be identically zero no matter what. Now, I will not prove it, but one has to emphasize that this is true holds for all Xi's and for all sigmas. So this is a very strong requirement that this holds for all choices of Xi's and sigmas. And one can leverage these so this is just a stronger, well, semi-equivalent version of stating that theorem, but where we make explicit that we can extremize over all choices of Xi and all choices of sigma. This tells us that J Xi on shell is exact. So if you see that if this is true, that trivially a trivial consequence, it's a bit harder to reverse engineer things. In the notes, I give an abstract argument from the theory of local forms, local differential forms. But one can also do it by hand by really saying, oh, that formula must hold for every choice of Xi and every choice of sigma. What does this mean? And so on. In general, in fact, the structure of this current is like this. Generally, I can say a little bit more. I expect, one expects J off shell to be a quantity proportional to Xi with no derivative acting on Xi, plus a boundary term. And this guy vanishes on shell. Now, if I integrated over 3D surface, these will be my constraints of the theory. So the Gauss constraint, for example, is this guy over here. Okay. So this you will see for Young-Mills in the tutorial. Or let me write it constraint. So when I write this on a surface sigma, this becomes xi a c sigma. Doesn't really matter. What I mean is, these, let me call them constraints, and that's it. So, for example, Gauss in Young-Mills. So you can. The point is that if that equation holds without the obstruction, then the bulk part is what is generating off-shell the gauge transformation. On-shell, these guys must be zero. And there is a relation here to to symplectic reduction, and I will talk about it at another point. But so if you're not imposing the equations of motion anywhere, we see that it modulo potential obstructions, which don't appear in Young-Mills because we are in this case, then the Gauss constraint, the constraint, the bulk part of J is what generates the symmetries in the covariant phase space, because we write I rho xi of omega sigma. So I'm integrating over sigma. Sigma has no boundaries. And this becomes minus dq. But this is... And no obstruction, s equals 0. So for example, in Young-Mills. But what is this? This is nothing else than minus the integral of xi alpha d sigma alpha, right? So by this, so this is telling me that when everything goes for the best, this constraint, the bulk part of the Noether current, is the generator of the gauge transformation of shell. OK, I will come back to this formula at a later point. So if all goes for the best, the constraint generates gauge transformations off-shell. And this is an off-shell statement. Because on-shell, the constraint vanishes, and this is degenerate as a consequence. And that's kind of requires a bit more work. Questions? I will now present this, questions about this? No. I want to quickly go through, I hesitated whether to do this or not. I think I'm doing it. I want to talk a second about the ambiguities, because I've been working with all these objects as if they were perfectly well-defined, uniquely defined, but they're not. Because oftentimes, like, take the first equation over there. I start from the variation of L, and I get a boundary term. And then I use this R. But R, if I add to R any d exact object, that equation is still valid. So R is not fully well-defined. And then, therefore, J is not fully well-defined. So what is going on? Why can't I speak about these things at all? OK, so first, there is the point that the reason why when introducing a Lagrangian at the end of the day is to extract nice equations of motion. But even then, the Lagrangian itself can be redefined up to boundary terms. So the Lagrangian itself is can be redefined by adding a boundary local form, like a. So what happens under this change? Well, I find that my equations of motion, the equations of motion under this change are unchanged because they just see the bulk part, right? You keep, you vary these. E is the is comes from the bulk piece. Since this has a D, there will always be a D in front, so E will never see that piece. Remember, or should I write it? Maybe here. I write the formula that defined the object. I take this variation. Whatever comes from here will be hiding inside there. And indeed, this is what happens. Theta will go to theta. Given the choices of signs, I suppose this is minus delta L. So, but here I realize, oops, there is a D in front of this theta, so there is not just the delta L that appears. There is a second ambiguity, which is I can always add a new D of something. Okay, so now that I have theta and I have L, I need to, and if I care about computing the Noether current, I need to know what defines, oops, my R. So this is the equation for R, and it's clear that if I change R by, L by a d-exact term, R will go to what? Will go to, well, let's call it R of psi. There will be the variation of little l right there. So, but again, it's hiding inside a D. Therefore, there is an extra ambiguities that I don't know how to call, so I will call it little r in that way. Now, okay, now these are all the ingredients I need to run those theorems. So I can compute the Noether current. So the Noether current is given by, remember, is given there. The formula is the contraction of theta with rho and minus r. So there will be a combination of these guys coming in. So this becomes the Noether current. Oops. And how do they play with each other? Well, look, if I do the contraction with rho for here, I get the lead derivative of L. This is also lead derivative of L. It looks like I messed up the signs somehow. But these two cancel. I'm not sure exactly which sign I did wrong. Are they wrong? I think they are wrong, right? Yeah, anyway, the 2L end up canceling. Let me put a plus here. I'm a bit confused why, but so this, the L cancel, so no L, but there is R and theta contribute. So R, this becomes, I haven't updated my notes with the new convention, so I'm not fully sure about the signs. The signs are wobbly, don't take them too seriously. So there is this extra piece at the boundary, up to plus and minuses. Okay, so the Noether current, we see that, again, its bulk piece, which could have been influenced by this L, but this doesn't happen, is well-defined. What is not well-defined is the boundary piece. So when we say that this van on shell is d little j becomes d of little j. So let me write it here. So this little j goes to J plus that stuff. Plus, once again, this is inside a D, so there could always be an extra D. Okay, so it kind of goes down from there. But the important thing is what is not changing. So same for I didn't compute it, I should have done it earlier, omega. Omega is affected by this 2, becomes D square, but D square is 0. So this is not there. And again, this is D of D theta. Okay. So again, this is a pure boundary. So what we discover is that the bulk here is unchanged. And here too. Therefore, when I do if there is no boundary, and remember, this was implying that Q sigma is conserved, omega sigma is conserved, and so on. What happens is that they're not only conserved, but they're also completely unambiguous objects. And omega sigma are unambiguous. The situation changes if sigma has corners. And then you really have to work harder to make sense to say, how do I disambiguate my expressions? There's no obvious rule to do this. Those things are intrinsically there. So you have to have some criterion, which is not given by the mathematical theory of these differential forms, but something else, something that tells you, I don't know, I want my charge to be 0 for Schwarzschild, and rather, or for Minkowski, sorry, and then maybe you can add some counter terms that you tune to that for that to happen, and then you use those. But you add boundary conditions, you do something, but it's not given a priori to you. So if, but if delta sigma is different from 0, this is the Wild West. So everybody's on its own, and you have to figure it out by yourself. Okay. So this point will be relevant. Later on. In the application to the world entropy, we will see that we will use boundary conditions to fix some of this problem, in fact. We will need it. Any questions? Otherwise, I move on to GR and give the formulas for GR that we will use next time. I'll do a quick derivation of how where they come from, and some comments about, because they look a bit weird, some of them. Okay, so finally, we get to general relativity. So let's say what is the field space of general relativity. This is the space of metrics. One could say this is the Riemannian structure in with signature D1 over M, right? In any case, we will not use this. It's just notation. Now, what is the action for this? Let me start from the Einstein-Hilbert action. This I like to write like that, just to put everything to one eventually. But Okay, so this is the Ricci scalar, the cosmological constant, and these two, this is h bar, and this is L Planck. So L Planck, different authors define it differently. For me, this is 8 pi g h bar. Why I choose this particular convention is because when I put this number to 1, and not just big G to 1, I get a canonical kinetic term, h dot square. So if I perturb this around Minkowski and so on, for I get, and so this looks 1/2 h dot square. So this is why this looks good to me. It gives canonical commutation relations that give 1 on the right-hand side of the Poisson bracket and so on. So to me, this looks like the natural choice. Some formulas you're very used to will look a bit weird with this convention. I will comment on them when we get there. Now, something that is weird about this action principle, there are two things that are weird. One, it's non-polynomial. Here there are inverse matrix everywhere appearing. So is this a problem? It's not a problem in the classical theory, but it makes, if you think of quantizing something that is non-polynomial, you get a bit itchy because there are all sorts of ambiguities in how you define operator ordering. Like it's a bit of a nightmare. So you don't care for the classical theory. You can get nervous about the quantum one. So there is a way to fix this. Fixable using Palatini-Cartan formalism, for example. Palatini-Cartan or Ashtekar formalism. And this means that you keep tetrad and spin connection independent as independent field. Because where does the inverse matrix come from? Well, it comes from the gammas, basically, and contracting those objects. So if you call the gammas their own field, you can fix it. Some of the equations of motion will tell you that your connection is torsion-free. So you will get it as an equation of motion instead. Two, and there will be a tutorial, in fact, about that. Point two, that is weird, which is more troubling even from the classical point of view, is that there are second derivatives in this action. We never wrote before an action with second derivatives inside. So is this a problem? Yes and no. Depends what you're trying to do. So for the equations of motion, you don't care. They come out second order anyway, which is a bit puzzling. In fact, Einstein was confused, I think, about this at first when he was trying to find action principle because he was looking for something with just first order derivatives. But then you have to write some weird stuff where you play around with the gammas. You can write it, but it doesn't take this super nice simple form. One consequence is that when you take, it doesn't give you a well-defined action principle in the sense that the variation of this is not proportional to delta G, but there are derivatives in front of delta G, so what are you fixing when you do the action principle? The way to fix this, so this gives problems with action principle, which means that the boundary term is about the boundary term. So theta is not proportional to delta g. There are derivatives in front of delta g. And this is fixable by adding a boundary term to this action, a boundary piece, the York-Gibbon-Sokin term. So this would be, I add it here in, so with the same Planck square, this is the boundary matrix times the trace of the extrinsic curvature over there. Okay, so we will work. So you see, adding this boundary term over here is part of this little L ambiguity over there. So that's exactly the type of correction one could have in mind. Good. So after this, let's work out the different pieces. To work out the different pieces, what one needs is, and here I will not do the computation at the blackboard, but I want to give a more conceptual way of sketching the proof of this. So when to compute, we need to take variations of the Ricci. Variation of the Ricci, let's say they are, this is a sketch. So remember that variations of the curvature in Yang-Mills, this is what I did yesterday in tutorial, take the nice form that they are covariant derivative of the variation of A. So the curvature, not so much the Ricci in reality, but more like the Riemann, but up to, that's why I say up to details. But the variation of the curvature is kind of the same. Geometrically, these are both curvature, and they both can be computed as commutation of covariant derivatives. Modulo details, there are important details here, but again. Because of these, here you will find a similar structure. So this will be some covariant derivative with indices mixed up appropriately of your connection. And in this case, the connection is the gamma. Now, the gamma, here is where one has to work a little bit, is something like that. Structurally again. And then what is the variation of something like this? Well, the variation, you see, the variation of a connection here is something that transforms in the adjoint representation. It transforms homogeneously. Objects that transform homogeneously under coordinate transformations, they are tensors. Gamma is not a tensor, but this variation is a tensor. Exactly like here. Therefore, the variation of this, in fact, turns out to be, so there's no analog of this formula in Yang-Mills, but the fact that you know that this should be a tensor is that it must contain delta g, it has derivatives in front of it. The only thing that makes sense is that you get something of this sort. So this is okay. So this is very schematic. Of course, you cannot get then there are variations of g that one has to take and so on. But this schematic expression, which one can work out in detail, will now justify what I'm about to write. I will use it to justify what is coming up. And this is the following. If I take the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian and I vary it, I get delta GAB EAB. Minus d of theta. So what are these objects? This EAB is minus 1/2 of the equations of motion as you would probably write them yourself. So epsilon and this theta is 1/2, and here is my point that comes into play. This is delta B G AB minus dA dG. So this is the trace of delta GAB. It's not the variation of the determinant. So, okay. Now this is this with the index raised. It's not the variation of the inverse, just to clarify. And this is the trace of the variation and not the variation of the trace. That wouldn't make sense. Okay, so the point is that the fact that here there is a derivative is this object. So when I have this in the variation of the bulk, when I pull it out on the boundary, I get this guy here. So the fact that there is these derivatives over there are these derivatives over here. But this is what is odd here, right? Because you don't get something proportional to delta G. And this is what this Gibbons-Hawking term would correct. So this is not a canonical, in a way, symplectic structure in that sense. OK, next, we need to look at symmetries. So here, there is another comment I want to make. What are the symmetries of GR? Diffeomorphism invariants, right? So the symmetries are diff of M, which is the vector fields on M. Now, well, I should put it a little d to be. Is the Lie algebra of diffeomorphism, which is the vector fields with their Lie bracket. What is the transformation of the metric? Well, let me write it like this. I like it a bit better. What is the transformation of the metric? It's the Lie derivative along psi. Which I can write like this. Now, you know that the Lie derivative is also the result of a change of coordinates. If I do a little change of coordinates, how does my tensor transform? It transforms like that. Here, my point is the following. I'm not thinking of this as a change of coordinates. I never mention coordinates. I have my manifold. I have two metrics on top of it. And these are two slightly different metrics, varied by where delta G in between them is given by this expression. So here, I'm comparing different metrics, not comparing different coordinates. I never mention coordinates. There is a bit of a curiosity for this in this case. So the usually remember, if we take two gauge transformations, they take the commutator of two actions, we get the action of the commutator. Here you get minus. So if you're doing computations in GR and you get a bit confused, it could be because here you have this minus. It's deeply embedded into all the conventions that you're using, and there's no point in trying to remove it. It's just there. It's because these are left actions, usually one takes right actions, stuff like that. So just be aware that there is a minus when you work in GR. So it's called an anti-homomorphism, but it's just a technical point that has no bearing on the abstract structures that we were looking at. Okay, now a word about general covariance or background independence. Independence, also called general covariance. What is it? So this is a statement about how your theory depends on space-time structures. So if you have a Lagrangian, which is background independent, it means that the metric is dynamical with everything else, and there is no fixed structure on space-time that is not dynamically determined. So all fields appearing in the Lagrangian should be dynamical. Now, if I want to write something geometric that integrates nicely over manifolds and so on, I have a top form of sorts. And this top form, under coordinate changes of the has to transform as a Lie derivative. So this is out of consistency with coordinate invariance of what you're writing. But now we're looking at things from field space, from the field space perspective. It means that if I take all my fields, in this case I have just G mu nu, but if I add scalar fields, vector fields, whatever, if I all vary them under diffeomorphic symmetry, then this should reflect the coordinate change transformations. So general covariance is the statement that rho, the field space variation of the Lagrangian with all its fields is nothing else than the Lie derivative of the Lagrangian as a top form over spacetime. And this can be generalized to objects that are not the Lagrangian. Any field-dependent form that you're looking at, you can say it's background-independent if its Lie derivative equals it's the action on spacetime, over spacetime. So it is important to appreciate the difference of these two Lie derivatives, that they play very different roles. So suppose that I write the Lagrangian of a scalar field on Minkowski, as I did the other day, and I take a diffeomorphism of my dynamical field, which are just a scalar field. The metric is not part of field space because I'm not varying on it. I'm just leaving it alone. It's Minkowski written in arbitrary coordinates, so it might not be -1, -1, -1, but it's a fixed metric. So this will not act. The rho will act just on the phi field, and this equation will not be true. For this equation to be true, I need to vary the metric as well there. And this is true if I add background vector fields or any other structures that is not varied, this equation would be broken. Okay, so I think I ran out of time, but we will see. What I wanted to compute was J, give you an expression for J, the current, and an expression for the flow equation, like the contraction of omega with rho and so on. J you have to compute. You just compute it out of, well, we haven't computed R yet, so, but you compute J and you compute J. But the nice thing is that that equation, the obstruction equation, you can identify the obstruction S, the little s over there, just out of general covariance. Its structural form is completely fixed by this type of equation. So it's something that you have any time that diffeomorphism, like you are working in a background independent theory, that it will have that type of structure, the little s. Okay, so I leave it I leave it here. It was a bit slower than expected, but so next time, after writing down these things, I will jump on applying those formula to Walt's derivation of the, you know, there is this famous paper called Black Hole Entropy is a Neutral Charge. And so we will go through that derivation. And the starting point will be that equation over there, like the flow equation in GR. And the idea is to read out of it T delta S equal omega delta J plus delta M, you know, like the usual force law of black hole mechanics. Yeah.
So when you said the symmetries of GR are diffeomorphisms, I would expect that those are gauge symmetries, right? So what are the actual symmetries? Is it like isometries or something?
Yeah. So these are gauge symmetries. There are no isometries in GR. Like, there are isometries, but they're not, they're a property of a specific metric. They're not properties of all metrics. So indeed, given one metric, you can have isometries, and these give you global symmetries. So the example we did was the scalar field on Minkowski, and we computed the neutral current for the global symmetries, which are the 10 Killing vector fields. Or even if you have one, you can have one global symmetry, and then you compute its neutral charge. And what you find is that you have a stress energy tensor, and the neutral current is that stress energy tensor contracted with the Killing vector field associated to your isometry. But here we are working in a much more general context where all possible metrics are allowed. And so there is no global symmetry over, like, generally, if you restrict to subsectors of the theory, maybe, like, all black hole solutions have, stationary black hole solution have a time-like Killing vector field. But there you are putting stationary in your definition, and so that's why you get it. But generally speaking, there is none. And so GR has no global symmetries, and everything is encoded in its gauge symmetry of diffeomorphism. We will see that this is true at a very deep level. In fact, you can reconstruct GR fully from its diffeomorphic symmetries and some technical assumptions, which are important, but they will sound technical, not very physical. I will discuss this in the last lectures, this fact, that you can reconstruct GR from different invariants.